Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's show. I am Jeff Lambert, a member of the International Criminal Court Student Network and also a senior here at Central Michigan. And I'm joined by my good friends and also members of the International Criminal Court Student Network, Erica Maley.
Hi.
And Hope May.
Hello.
And today we're talking about violence and the relationship between it and power. And the goal of today's show is to understand the nature of violence and power and if violence is ever legitimate to obtain power. We'll be focusing on Hannah Arendt's piece called On Violence, and so we'll be referencing that throughout the show. To begin, we're just going to go and see if any of our guests have anything to say and share their favorite clips. So I'm going to start with Erica.
All right. Hi, everyone. I guess the clip that I found most interesting in Hannah Arendt's article is a quote that she took from Voltaire, where he says, or she says, I don't know, power consists in making others act as I choose. And that just stuck with me because I don't necessarily think that all the time because in my class, another class that I'm taking this semester, we've talked about the difference between coercion and leadership and how there are different types of power, and one's the correct way and one's the incorrect way. And I don't think that I'm not sure that he was considering this when he made this statement.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So when you said one is the correct way and one is the incorrect way,
yeah.
So in your view, is coercion always incorrect?
I think so. I don't think you can say always. I don't think you can always give a definite answer about every situation, but I think the majority of the time that coercion is the incorrect way.
Hmm.
Because, like, if you're leading someone, like, people want to do it, and coercion, you're just making them, and I don't think that that's the correct way.
Hmm.
So what you're saying is leadership depends on not only the abilities of the leadership, but also the people that they have power over.
Yeah, yep. And I don't know, like some ideas, like some things that came to mind when I was thinking about this is like being a leader can give you power or you can have, or having power makes you a leader. But like I don't think like getting people to do what you want is really like power that should make you a leader. Like I think you're just being a bully. So, and also, like, another concept that from my class was that coercion runs counter to working with followers to achieve a common goal. And so I think, like, power is for, like, yourself. It's like a like when you're using power or coercion, like the form of power as coercion, that's, like, a really selfish way to use it. You should be using it, like, to serve others and work together.
Absolutely. That's pretty much close to what Hannah Arendt also says. We'll be getting to that a little later. But not to get ahead of ourselves, I'm going to introduce my favorite clip or what I liked most about the piece. It's a quote coming on page 45 from it, from Hannah Arendt's article, and it says, "To remain in authority requires respect for the person or the office. The greatest enemy of authority, therefore, is contempt, and the surest way to undermine it is laughter." And it made me think, well, first of all, it surprised me that laughter was introduced into a piece on violence. And when I was thinking about it, you know, it's really true because, you know, someone with power could be like a father figure or a grandparent or a mother. And, you know, they kind of lose their power when their child doesn't take them seriously anymore because what the orders that they give them aren't going to be followed because, like I said, they're not taking them serious. And, you know, if you've ever been spanked as a child or something and you go back into your room and you start laughing with it. It's like a way to cope, and all of a sudden the spanking loses its power and its authority over you. So I just thought it was really cool that she brought this in to the context of governments and states and at such a realm different than children and parents.
Hmm.
And with that, we'll move to Hope's thoughts about the piece.
Well, I just want to say that I found this reading difficult, and I had to read it 3 times, and I don't claim to understand it. But throughout, when she's talking about power. At one point, well, first of all, I want to say that it seems to me that it's important to point out that she's distinguishing this received view of power, which is like obedience, this whole idea of dominance and submission, master and commander, and that's sort of been the traditional view of power, and she takes issue with that. Do you guys agree with that interpretation?
Absolutely.
Okay, just checking. And instead, she has us look to the Romans and the Greeks, and she says something like, they were not coming together and organizing a society through dominance and submission. That was not sort of the idea that put those societies in play, but it was support of the laws, and this is on page 40 and 41. So support of the laws to which the citizenry had given its consent. So the idea here is that there's this coming together around some principles that are enshrined in the law, and people are sort of rallying around these and going, yeah, we like those, and they're buying into those principles. And afterwards, when she's talking about power, she uses, like on pages 40 and 41, she uses support, and she uses phrases like keeping together, initial getting together, and just support in general. So it seems that she's talking about power in the sense that there's some unity and solidarity, and people are all buying into the same laws or the same ideas, values, what have you. And I thought that was really interesting. It's not one passage, I apologize. It's just sort of like a theme in this. And I just want to use what I take her to be saying as an opportunity to investigate further to see what you guys think about the question of what is it that brings people together anyway. I mean, laws, yes, but what is it that causes the unity in the first place? So, of course, we can point to instances of people being organized and unified. To use a very simple example, you know, everybody supports a certain sports team. So why is it that people support that team? What brings them to the others in the first place? And I don't think that she addresses that or makes any sort of evaluative claims as to certain glue is better than others, if that makes sense. But yeah, that's just, it's not really, I'm not really reading a passage. I'm just sort of highlighting in this theme. I could say more about it, but I'll stop right now.
yeah, it's a great question. I think that what's happening is that she says domination is necessary, and other scholars have thought this too, that without a domination, there is no structure to the world in terms of statehood.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, it's necessary that certain institutions have authority over the citizenry or whoever is being commanded by them. But I have here written down that what I take the nature of power to mean, and we're getting into part one of our discussion, but it's a perfect segue. So what I take this to mean is that the consent of the people and the institution and its power, or the consent of the people gives the institution its power, and that consent makes future actions by that institution legitimate,
mm-hmm.
granted that they stay true to what was consented upon. So I don't think that it's an absolute power.
Mm-hmm.
The people, it's all about opinion and consent, and as you pointed out, words like support and unity. So long as the majority of the citizenry still buy in and unquestionably buy into that institution, I think the powers remain. So I don't think it's necessarily something that has to keep re-happening. Like, people don't have to keep regathering to make the power that the institution has legitimate anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I thought from the power. Erica, do you have anything to add?
You should come back to me in a second.
So I just want to let everyone know out there listening that you can always call in and ask us a question or give a comment at 646-727-3928, and we'll be taking callers if they do call in. So keeping with this nature of power, there's a quote that Hannah Arendt says, and it says, "Power springs up whenever people get together and act in concert, but it derives its legitimacy from the initial getting together than from any action that may follow." So since we're all members of the International Criminal Court Student Network, and if anyone's been listening, the past couple months we have dedicated our lives to studying the International Criminal Court. So to tie it in, I'm going to put this question out to you guys. Do you agree with that latter statement, and is there any correlation with the International Criminal Court and especially with the signing of the Rome Statute?
Okay, I can take a first crack at this. Well, I think like how it correlates to the ICC and those state parties that are that have signed and ratified the Rome Statute is that like now that these states have come together in the body that makes up those involved with the court, like they have this common goal now of like ending impunity and preserving international justice and these things. And so like the actions that they take now with the court, they legitimize by these common goals that they have. And I mean, whether their actions are legitimate all the time, I guess it's up to interpretation, but I think that they feel they're legitimate in the actions that they take because they are all together in it. They all see each other as like approving of this action. And I kind of think it relates to like how there's like power in numbers, like something that you maybe would be scared to do on your own or wouldn't be gutsy enough. Once you have other people rallying around you that are saying, yeah, like do it, go for it, like that people actually do it. And so I think that that's how this relates, that it gets its legitimacy because I guess the other people that are allowing you to do it or going along with it are telling you it's legitimate, which I don't really know if that makes it legitimate then because the ones who are doing it are claiming it's legitimate. So, I mean, where is like the perspective that's not inside it?
Very good question. And I just want to say that Hannah Arendt explicitly says in her piece that there is power in numbers. So just to say that. But also just to give a quick little background of Hannah Arendt, she's in her past works, especially in The Human Condition, she speaks of action and how it's different from labor and work, which that's a whole other show. But involved in that action is a necessity of communication. So I think that this, what Erica said, that all these states got together and signed the Rome Statute and there was a solidarity behind it, but it was through communication. And that's also one of the things that NATO used to make their bombings of Yugoslavia in the 90s. That's what they used to say that their actions were legitimate, even though the UN said it wasn't. But I just wanted to throw that out there in response. Hope, do you have anything to add?
Yeah. So I guess I'll just challenge this ideological optimistic view that I'm hearing, so unlike me, and say, yeah, sure, a bunch of states and civil society all went to Rome, and there was a single document that was produced called the Rome Statute, which put into effect and made real this idea of a permanent international criminal court. But I'm going to give like a metaphor, and I want you, you know, you all to think of pizza pie, and but each slice in that pie has different toppings on it. So you've got, you know, the sausage, you've got the pepperoni, you've got the pineapple, black olives, margarita, you know, nothing on it, just cheese. And I would say, you know, if you step back far enough, you do see, you know, one thing that all of these different nations are rallying around, which is the Rome Statute and the court. But if you zoom in, so if you pan out, you see one thing. But if you zoom in, you see that they're really, like, the pie, there's one pie, but they're all going after a different piece, meaning piece, P-I-E-C-E, of the pie, meaning that each state signing the Rome Statute has its own interests for doing so. There are some states that, sure, have this idealistic view that we need to end impunity, and I would say that's part of that's, you know, rhetorical purposes, to give the court legitimacy, mm-hmm. as if you could argue with ending impunity.
Right.
So, of course, they want to use a language that that people buy into. So that's good PR on the part of the court. In terms of why states actually are members of the court, sure, there's that noble purpose involved, but other states are doing it for PR purposes, and that's borne out by the fact that member states such as Chad, although signatories to the Rome Statute, don't actually enforce it. So there are people who've signed it, but they don't take it seriously, meaning that they had other interests in signing it in the first place. There are other states that do it because they don't have a strong international justice system or justice system to begin with, so they need something bigger to come in. So I would say there are all of these, you know, getting back to groups, different sets of interests going on here, and they're all sort of rallying around this one locale. And so I would just say I would take a more skeptical view and say that, sure, ending impunity, that's the PR of the court, but when you get down to the reality of how states are actually implementing their duties, we can come away with a less optimistic picture. And it raises questions for how these words are used by states, because the average person gets really fired up around, you know, crimes against humanity and genocide. There's no term that really creates more moral outrage than genocide. People point to Hitler as a symbol of evil, and that gets the average person riled up, and states have an interest in pushing our buttons that way. That's it.
All right. Yeah, just it's definitely interesting because there is always the ability for people to hide behind rhetoric and a point that we'll get to in the second part of the show for sure. But yeah, definitely listeners, keep that in mind for the second part. Okay, to wrap up this first section on the nature of power, I just want to put out there that we discussed it before, but Arendt takes this, it's pretty radical in terms of past accepted definitions of a state, that say that a state is the legitimate monopoly over violence, and Arendt completely eliminates violence from the definition of power. So in terms of that, is just putting this to the group and to the listeners, does that change the way you view the power structure of states, or does it change the way in which you view legitimate actions by the states, or anything? Does it change the way that you view the power structure? Erica? No? Hope?
Oh, yeah, sure. I would say that as a student of the classical philosophers, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and I'm thinking of Socrates in particular, no, I mean, I say word up to that. She didn't change my view. It sounds right. It rings true because of my study of Socrates and the early dialogues. And I never have thought that violence is, you know, a necessary component of power. Socrates, at the end of the Apology, says, you know, you're actually, in another dialogue, he says, no harm can come to a good man. So if you can't harm someone who's good with whatever implements you have, then what power do you have in the first place? And, of course, if one knows about, you know, nonviolent movements and the power that organized groups of people have, you understand that violence is not a necessary component of power. So I like how when she does talk, and I guess before we move to part two, I just want to make sure that I understand what she means by power. And we do have a caller. Should I take that?
Absolutely.
Okay. I'll take the call. Caller, are you there?
Hi, this is Andy Blom.
Oh, hi, Andy. How are you?
Hi. I'm just listening in.
Okay. We're talking about, have you been listening?
I have.
Okay. So do you want to correct any misconceptions?
No, I haven't heard anything that sort of wildly misrepresents how I read Arendt or, everything so far sounds good.
Okay. So could you, in a nutshell, sum up what her definition of power is? Because I don't think I understand it.
Well, in a nutshell, Arendt takes power to be not the ability of individuals. It's not a kind of capacity that one can exercise on one's own. Rather, it's a kind of capacity that is only ascribable to groups. It's a capacity that comes into existence when groups figure out a way to act, as she says, in concert. So really, it's a capacity of collective action.
Mm-hmm.
And
violence
now,
is not a necessary part of it because?
She makes the provocative statement that violence and power are really opposites. Power doesn't require the people who are acting in concert to be under threat of violence to compel their actions into this sort of concerted form of action. Rather, Arendt views violence as resting on a certain form of consent, I think a relatively weak form of consent. I think the reason that she sees violence as being opposed to power is because violence entails a violation of consent. It entails a violation of a kind of mutual recognition or mutual promise that we can make to each other when agreeing to act together for a common purpose.
Okay, thank you for clearing that up.
Yeah,
I still find it relatively unclear. I agree with you. I heard you mention earlier that reading Arendt was difficult, and I sympathize
mm-hmm.
with that.
It's
probably not among the clearest of her works, but I think that even in general, Arendt tends to be a very provocative writer, and she says these things that I think on the surface sound right, but then it really sort of presses you as a reader to try to work on interpreting exactly how this all plays out.
It's great fun.
So that seems like a perfect way to jump into part two of our show, which is the relationship between violence and power. And as Andy just said, Arendt takes those to be opposites, although they do exist together, and they usually do exist together. So what I've taken from this is pretty much a violence and a power dichotomy. So power, as Andy said, exists without necessarily violence being there, but violence is usually accompanied by power. But also what Arendt says is that as power becomes in jeopardy, which means as the cohesion of the group that is giving power to the institutions that are in authority, as that is jeopardized or as that begins to disintegrate, those in authority tend to lean on violence to try and rebuild that power. But she also points out that violence cannot create power. So I want to move into a direct quote from her piece, which is, this is what she says, quote, "To substitute violence for power can bring victory, but the price is very high, for it is not only paid by the vanquished, but also paid by the victor in terms of his own power," which goes back to that violence cannot create power, but violence can destroy power. That's another thing that she explicitly says in the piece. So I'm going to put another question to the group. Do you agree with this statement? And also, when I read the statement, I think of the current situation in Libya, and I think that this kind of proves your point, but I'm just wondering what you guys think about the statement that I just read.
Okay, so just to make sure, like, I'm understanding this, and hopefully listeners understand it, she's saying that, like, the violence that they use to, like, try to hold on to their power can also, like, weaken their power? Is this basically...
Not kind of also, it does weaken
it
their
does
power.
It does weaken
yes.
their power. Okay, good. Yeah, I guess I can see that that makes a lot of sense because, like, they're struggling to, I guess, like, keep these people where they want them,
mm-hmm.
The people that they're oppressing or controlling or have power over, but that just creates a lot of resentment, and I think that ultimately that oppression is what finally drives those groups to rally together and overthrow dictators or people like that. And I think you've seen a lot of this in the news lately, where countries are just they're finally its citizens have had enough of these dictators. And that's how I perceive it. I mean, does anyone else? I mean, am I on point here?
No,
am I,
absolutely.
Okay.
I also think of the recent situation in Egypt as well, where the government cut off the internet, shut off phones, tried to do everything that they could to restrict communication between the peoples who were obviously dissatisfied. And what's funny is when they enacted those, which is would fall under violence because it's not only physical acts, but it's also the threat of terror and things of that nature. What it did is actually drove the people together and likewise drove those in power or in authority, to use Arendt's terms correctly, they actually, he resigned. So I think that with Libya and especially Egypt, for me, like, that just proves that point tenfold. Hope, do you have anything to add?
I guess I want to go back to this claim, violence cannot create power. And earlier, Andy, I think you said that violence, if it's based on anything, it's based on, like, a weak consent. Did I hear that correctly?
Power. Yeah, power is based on a weak consent.
Power is based on a weak consent. And so violence, however, can be used. It can be justified, but it's not legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
Arendt makes that claim, yep.
Okay. So does that have anything to do with this, with consent? It's justification, is my question.
So I think for Arendt, consent plays an important role in the legitimacy of power. So the claim that she makes in the piece is that power does not require justification. That is, it's the sort of thing that is by default not morally in question, the way that violence is by default morally in question. Violence calls for justification in a way in which power does not. What power does require from Arendt's view is legitimacy. And so these terms, I mean, as we use them in moral discourse, as your listeners may or may not be aware, tend to have a different directionality. So that is, legitimacy is a judgment that tends to look towards the conditions of the past, whereas justification tends to look for its standard in the future. So for legitimacy, what Arendt is looking for are the circumstances under which power came about. When did people begin to act in concert in this particular way? When was this particular form of collective action brought into being, and under what conditions? Now, she doesn't say a great deal about this. I would say some of her readers have taken this to mean that she has something close to a sort of social contract story, where that power tends to come about under a mutual promise of those who are engaged in collective action to abide by the principles that are going to guide their project and to throw their energies into that project. So legitimacy tends to derive from that sort of initial coming together, that initial founding of the collective project. And it's something that I think if we're sort of to read Arendt in a plausible sense, we can't think that it's something that only had to exist at one time, but something that has to be renewed as power goes on, that people who continue to be engaged in these collective projects as they're handed on from sort of one generation of actors to another. I mean, whether we think of that in terms of lifetimes or just in terms of the way in which the sort of actors within an institution turn over as the institution goes on, that commitment needs to be renewed, that kind of promise of the people within the institution to be committed to its principles and to throw their energies into it needs to be renewed. And I was thinking about this kind of analysis, especially when you were talking about the International Criminal Court earlier.
Mm-hmm. So my question is, so if violence can never be legitimate, is that because just because the way she's defining legitimacy is it only has to do with the past? Because my question is, can't I like come together with people in a sort of social contract way and say, look, we're all going to abide by these laws and use violence in these circumstances, and we all agree mm-hmm. to that? Why is it the case that violence cannot be legitimate if, on some story, we've come together and we said we're going to use violence in these cases.
So that is to use violence against each other, those who sort of who have entered against
we're
those very people who have
a
entered
minority
into
who rises up. We all agree. because the minority, I guess, wouldn't agree to that.
Right. Well, I take it that's Arendt's point, that okay. to end up using violence against a minority is to violate that minority, to violate the kind of promise that you've made to get along with that minority. Now, I think that the kind of situation that you've described is problematic on her account because the sort of conditions on which you would the use of violence would be acceptable is sort of written into the founding, so that it seems mm-hmm. like everyone is sort of agreed that, while I may hope that I'm not going to be a person in that minority, I would agree that it's legitimate to use violence under those circumstances.
Right. Okay.
I think that's a challenge to Arendt's view. I'm not sure that she has much of an answer to that sort of scenario.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah, I certainly didn't see any allusion to that at all. So, I guess to keep things going with this, with our studies in the international realm, what I'm thinking is this violence can extend between a domestic violence or an international violence. And to jump into this train of thought, we have a clip to play from President Obama at his Nobel Peace Prize speech. So we will play that clip now.
Yeah, and I just want to say that the clip is around 2 minutes long, and if you want to watch the whole speech, it's at our show resources page, ethicstalk.cmich.edu, and here's the clip, about 2 minutes.
To begin with, I believe that all nations, strong and weak alike, must adhere to standards that govern the use of force. I, like any head of state, reserve the right to act unilaterally, if necessary, to defend my nation. Nevertheless, I am convinced that adhering to standards, international standards, strengthens those who do, and isolates and weakens those who don't. The world rallied around America after the 9/11 attacks and continues to support our efforts in Afghanistan because of the horror of those senseless attacks and the recognized principle of self-defense. Likewise, the world recognized the need to confront Saddam Hussein when he invaded Kuwait, a consensus that sent a clear message to all about the cost of aggression. Furthermore, America, in fact, no nation, can insist that others follow the rules of the road if we refuse to follow them ourselves. For when we don't, our actions appear arbitrary and undercut the legitimacy of future interventions, no matter how justified. And this becomes particularly important when the purpose of military action extends beyond self-defense or defense of one nation against an aggressor. More and more, we all confront difficult questions about how to prevent the slaughter of civilians by their own government, or to stop a civil war whose violence and suffering can engulf an entire region. I believe that force can be justified on humanitarian grounds, as it was in the Balkans or in other places that have been scarred by war. Inaction tears at our conscience and can lead to more costly intervention later. And that's why all responsible nations must embrace the role that militaries with a clear mandate can play to keep the peace. America's commitment.
Right, so that was a clip from President Obama's speech when he received the Nobel Peace Prize. And again, you can watch the whole speech, which is about 37 minutes long, at our show resources page, ethicstalk.cmish.edu. Jeff?
All right. I just want to point out in that speech that President Obama says that there's acceptance and recognition of self-defense as an appropriate use of violence, and Hannah Arendt also echoes that sentiment in there as well. So in terms of that, violence doesn't need justification because of obvious reasons. So he also said that he reserves the right to defend himself unilaterally against foreign aggressors. And I'm just wondering what you guys think. Is there a difference between domestic violence and international violence? Is it the same? Should the same rules still hold? Or is when you change to the international scene, do the rules also change? Erica, do you have anything to say, or would you want me to?
I guess just like first glance at this.
Go for it.
I don't know. I mean, if domestic or international, I mean, if people are still being harmed, and sometimes I honestly think that the domestic issues are worse than the international ones, and so I don't know. I mean, I don't know that there's necessarily a difference. What do you guys think?
I want to know what Andy thinks.
Well, I suppose there's a lot of things that come to mind. I guess the first thing that that came to my mind is that, well, there seems to be a significant difference in the circumstances, in the sense that we tend to have a lot of institutions whose normal functioning we can rely on in the domestic case, whereas we have a paucity of institutions at the international level. And I think in some ways this connects to Arendt's point about the sort of interplay of power and violence. To the extent that power is operating well, violence is unnecessary, is not usually one of the strategies that those who are trying to govern or trying to carry out a certain kind of policy will resort to, because they can rely on the ordinary functioning of institutions that have the, in Arendt's term, the consent of those who are subject to them. And I think we can rely on a lot of that in the domestic case, so that when the police come through the neighborhood and they're looking for someone, they can more or less rely on other people not to interfere, or they can rely on others to point them towards the person that they're trying to apprehend. They can rely on others to turn over someone who's a fugitive from the law, and so on. And we don't have that kind of well-functioning set of institutions always at the international level. So I think that there's a sense in which actors in the international scene may be quicker to look towards strategies of violence rather than taking advantage of those of power that are available.
I have some Yep, I have something to comment on what he just said, and it has to do with a phrase that I pulled out of Hannah Arendt's article. It was immense negative unity, and the way I understood it was that that is when the majority refuses to use its power and overpower disruptors who are in a minority, and so they're sort of like bystanders that aren't doing anything, and this contributes to the problem, and they become, as she describes it, an ally of the minority. So from what he just said, I'm just trying to see if I think, does this relate in any way that at the international level there aren't these institutions that you would have at the national level then that people like respect to overpower it? Or I'm not sure, how does that relate?
Yeah, so I'm trying to recall the point the passage that you're pointing to in Arendt suggests that in a situation where violence is being used, that a number of sort of inactive bystanders can actually make the situation worse. Was that the sense of the passage?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I suppose that, I mean, what that's indicative of is the absence of power operating in that kind of situation where those who are, well, I don't know. I guess I'm it's unclear to me how exactly to apply this to situations of genocide. I mean, who are the actors that we're focusing on here? I mean, obviously, there's a certain kind of violence. I mean, so there's the violence of those who are carrying out humanitarian atrocities, and then there's the violence of those who are trying to intervene and stop humanitarian atrocities. It certainly seems like in the case of those who are carrying out humanitarian atrocities, there is a problem of course, you know, inactive bystanders who are in no way sort of helping the victims or enabling those who are carrying out the violence. Is that the kind of situation you were looking to apply this to?
Well, I don't know. I'm just thinking of how you use the example of like the police. Citizens are willing to assist them in their efforts to apprehend these suspects. But then when I think of like at the international level, a lot of times there are these atrocities going on, but like what countries are stepping up to deal with this?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's an immense negative unity that she's describing.
Yeah.
And I think like you can even think of, I feel like there's a growing discontent among people around the world for situations like that in Uganda and other places, and they're like, who's going to do something about this? And the people are concerned, but where are the nations? And is it their job to do that? But by doing nothing, are they contributing to the problem? And I think that's what she's hinting at in her article.
That's very interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, who was that? Hope.
That was me. I'm just,
oh,
right now seems like a perfect time to play our second clip of the show, which is actually going into international violence and the protection of so-called human rights. So I think we're going to play that second clip now.
Yeah, and then we'll come back to Erica's point, because I think there's more that needs to be said.
Absolutely.
And this is a former National Security Advisor, Scowcroft, talking, and he's talking about the decision for a NATO mission in Libya, and he's challenging the wisdom of that mission in this clip, and it's about 3.5 minutes long.
Grant pointed in the right direction? I'm not sure we are, no. I think we know.
I mean, we're talking about intervening militarily in Libya, right?
Yes, yes. We know little about the opposition in most of these places. One thing that is clear, that they are unified on getting rid of the leadership in most of these places. What's not clear is what they represent afterwards. And as Big said, frequently the aftermath of throwing out the old bad guys is a period of turmoil, and the success of the introduction of the toughest elements who know how to run a society. And that's one of the things that we have to be concerned about.
What about the other side of the coin? To sit back and have done nothing while people were slaughtered in Benghazi, say.
Okay. everywhere that there are people killed, the United States needs to intervene. How about Zimbabwe? You know, you have the same kind of circumstances. I think the pressures were great. Gaddafi is a man that's easy to hate and so on. But this is not the only place there's violence in the region. There's violence in Yemen, violence in Bahrain. Do we follow the same thing, that we're going to protect the protesters at any cost?
That's the question, is it not?
Well, obviously, if you can't intervene everywhere, you don't conclude that you interfere nowhere. You have to make a judgment. What are the circumstances? And in this particular case, once it became clear that there was a significant uprising in Libya, and once it became clear that Gaddafi was setting out to crush it, and to crush it absolutely brutally, not to respond to that would not only be morally dubious, but would be geopolitically questionable, because its after effects would be felt in Bahrain, in Yemen, perhaps even in Egypt and elsewhere. We have Tunisia, Algeria, and so forth. Remember, the Arab League came out quite clearly in opposing what he was doing. So we had no choice. Now, how do we go on from here is a difficult question. We have to define our objectives. My own gut feeling is that now that we're engaged, we have to make certain that the outcome is not a divided Libya, it's not a civil war, nor is it an entrenched, fierce, and revengeful Gaddafi in power.
Is that your point, General Scowcroft, that we can't make sure of all those things?
We can't make sure of them. And first of all, we are not unified about what we're about. We, the British and the French, have described it somewhat differently. The Germans abstained on the UN resolution. The Italians have gone back and forth on whether they would let their air bases be used. The Turks have grave reservations. And even the Arab League, who call for intervention, call for us to intervene, not them to intervene. And even within the Arab League, the problem is there is no unity on what it is we're trying to do. Are we trying to protect civilians? Are we trying to throw out Gaddafi? Are we going to end up owning Libya like we own Iraq, like we own Afghanistan? Is it going to be our problem? What about?
All right, so that's the end of the clip, and that is not on our show resources page, but it's from the PBS NewsHour from March 23rd, and it's a very interesting discussion. The other person speaking is Zbigniew Brzezinski, who's another former National Security Advisor, and then Jim Lehrer. Over to you, Jeff.
Okay, so to put it succinctly, the question that's on the table now is that, in light of known human rights violations, is it okay for a state to use military force against the state who is committing those violations? And that's a question that the last clip addressed, and it's one that we're going to try and tackle now. I just want to point out that before we get into this, that Gaddafi was a known human rights violator, and that also, to put it in terms of Hannah Arendt, his authority was lacking the consent of the people and relying on violence. And what Arendt says about that is that the more you rely on violence, the more impotent your government is. So, but then that also extends twofold. Is a group like NATO or a state like the United States of America, if they then use violence, does that also prove the impotence of their government? So I guess what we need to discuss now is, is it okay, regardless of the unforeseen future of the violent actions that we're going to take against these, is that still okay? Do we still need to stand up and do that? Or is it never okay to use violence in any means? Or is there some sort of qualifications we want to put on it? I'm going to put that to the group, and I also have something to say about it at the end. So, Erica or Hope or Andy, does any of you guys want to take the lead here?
There's immense negative unity here. I don't want to take the lead.
Okay.
Well, I guess I could say that I am sympathetic to the idea that this does sort of show in highlight in a certain sense the impotence of the U.S. and other intervening powers, in that there's there's very little that can actually be accomplished through the use of force aside from, you know, destroying some of Gaddafi's capability to go after civilians, which admittedly is an important aim, but that's a largely negative, largely destructive sort of aim. There's very little that can be done to assure that decent institutions emerge, that stable and relatively just social order emerges in Libya post-intervention. And I think all of that is, I think that what General Schofield was pointing out about the lack of a sort of unified purpose, or at least a well-formulated purpose. I don't even know if unified is necessary, but some sort of well-formulated goal makes that kind of violence rather dangerous, because it ends up being unrestrained, it ends up chasing after a whole bunch of different goals of those who are involved. So I think, I guess, so those are my first sort of 2 cents to get us going.
Hope you have anything.
Cool. That's what I have.
I also think that a big thing to do, okay, so Hannah Arendt says that violence is never legitimate, but it must be justified. What I'm thinking of is situations in which violence is justified are extreme, and what pops into my head immediately is Hitler, and he was performing mass atrocities and mass violations of human rights, but at the same time he was going across his own borders into other countries, which made it an international issue, which then I think is justification in itself for the international community to come in and defend itself, which is not necessarily the same thing that's going on in Libya while human rights violations are still occurring. So I mean, it's hard to say that we don't want to go in there and stand up for other humans and defend the people, the innocent and the civilians who have done nothing wrong and don't deserve the treatment that they're being given by their leaders. But at the same time, as the second clip shown, we can't foresee the future, and especially if the violence that we try to do in for the sake of the people could actually make their situation worse, it seems like if that's even a possibility, I'm very hesitant to use violence in that manner. I think at this point it's a good time to bring in another scholar, Iris Marion Young, who elaborates and criticizes Hannah Arendt's piece on violence. And in that, she says that she agrees that violence is never legitimate, but extends this to not only domestic affairs, but also internationally. And again, she says, it may be justified, but the violence must be carefully calculated and minimal damage to the innocent must be accomplished. And in her piece, she focuses on Yugoslavia in the 90s and how NATO went in with this so-called humanitarian effort, but actually made matters worse and actually sped up the process of some of these ethnic cleansings and things of like genocide and nature that was going on there, that the violence that NATO put on there, you know, made everything worse. And it's interesting, today I read two articles on Libya, and there's two cities, I forget the names of the cities, but they're kind of like the last two strongholds of Gaddafi's forces. And what they're doing now is they're hiding in highly populated civilian areas. So then, I mean, that poses lots of problems for the humanitarian effort in itself, because isn't violence against any human in itself a violation of human rights? So you have that, and then also, in terms of this impotence talk of the government, it seems like there should be other ways to induce an adherence to human rights violations, and it just seems like to jump the gun and to start bombing and missiling and doing all these things in a violent nature seems like it's too quick, and it does show the impotence of the institutions using violence to stick up for human rights. So that's my kind of wrap from all of this, and I've spent a lot of time on thinking about that. And also, you know, the unforeseen consequence is also like in Iraq, the stability of the country and the state structure and the power structure post the humanitarian violence. And in one of the articles I read from BBC, one of the front runners to take power after Gaddafi is removed is someone that the American forces actually captured and supposedly tortured during the Iraq campaign. So there's just all these things going on right now, and that's pretty much everything I had to say about it. Do any of you guys have anything to add or comment on?
Yeah, sure. Just going back to the Young piece, I just want to draw attention to, it's on page 284, and it's like the second paragraph, and she's basically laying out the conditions under which violence can be justified, and you must show that the consequences of the violent acts will prevent more harm than they produce, both in the domestic and the international realm. So violence is okay as long as, again, the harm that they're preventing more harm than they produce. They're going to produce harm, but you know, you're doing this for a future benefit, blah, blah, blah. And I just want to say, you know, tricky business for the reasons that Scowcroft says, and I just want to remind us all that Dick Cheney used this very argument for invading Iraq. He actually said the costs of not going are worse than the costs of going. And, of course, you know, measuring harm and benefit becomes very tricky. What are you measuring? How far into the future are you going? So on and so forth. And it seems like this kind of, quote, solution can be used by, I mean, you can use it in different ways, and you have it being used to justify violence that actually we could argue is worse. That, mm-hmm. In any case, I just wanted to leave that point that maybe it sounds nice to say, oh, all we have to do is make sure that if we're preventing more harm than we're producing. Oh, okay, that sounds good. But in the end, that just becomes really, really difficult, and any side can use it.
Absolutely. Erica or Andy, do you guys have any final thoughts?
I would just say that I agree with basically what both of you said, that it's hard when it's posed if this violence is for the greater good, I guess, what you should do. And I don't think there's an answer to that. And also about what you were saying, Jeff, about I just lost my train of thought. Hey, everyone.
It even happens to Marsha Coyle, my favorite person, who's a Supreme Court reporter. But anyway.
But yeah.
I threw a lot out in my little 2 minutes that I had.
Mm-hmm.
So, Andy, do you have anything to wrap up with a couple minutes left in our show?
Well, let's see. I mean, I guess just, I don't know if it's much of a wrap-up thought, but more just following off of Hope's last point is that I think Hope is quite right to point out that, that you know, making these kinds of long-ranging consequentialist judgments is really not an extremely difficult thing to do, especially when you're committing to a sort of policy of violence the way that we do in wartime. I mean, the consequences are notoriously unforeseeable. Wars end up being not at all what their planners thought they would be. I mean, Iraq is a case in point. and so I think that the kind of criterion that Young puts forward in her piece might be more suitable to sort of very isolated acts. I mean, I think she brings this up in the context of police violence or though actually that may be in the later part of the piece. But in any case, I mean, what she seems to have in mind is that, you know, in a very limited circumstance where you can foresee the immediate consequences of your actions, perhaps you could justify violence. But I think that when you're trying to do this on something of the scale of a war or an intervention, it's exactly the kind of tricky business that that Hope has indicated it is.
Absolutely, and I don't think that this discussion is over quite yet, because I also want to extend it to the ICC and their way of going about enforcing human rights violations versus violence. But I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to thank Andy Blom for calling in, and so Erica and Hope for your thoughts. And You're listening to Ethics Talk, and if you want to see any of our clips or hear the show again, it's at ethicstalk.cmich, which is cmich.edu. And thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks.
Bye.